Alrighty. And oh my gosh, I'm so excited. Kevin just got his 1 year cake last night. So let's welcome Kevin D from Santa Maria, our 10 minute speaker.
Hi everyone, I'm Kevin, I'm an alcoholic, if I can get that out. Thanks Jose Daniel for asking me to warm up, and thanks for hosting this, Kristen. A lot of newcomers, that is awesome. I'm still a newcomer. You guys are right in the middle of my 1 year victory tour, hitting every single cake meeting and chip meeting possible. And it's been such a success that they asked me to speak for 10 minutes. And after the meeting, it's been such a success also that there's concert shirts with my face on them and all the meetings I've hit on the back for sale. Yeah. Cheap. It has been 1 year. And the best thing I think about my first year, I think the real turning point for me in this program was the ninth month. Some light went on the ninth month. I just kept on working, I really listened hard. I didn't share that much in the first 9 months. I really listened really hard, and I tried to take the knowledge that this room was giving to me freely. And around the ninth month, it kind of hit me. Some may call it a spiritual awakening. I'm not sure if it was that, but it was some sort of awakening. And what the beauty of that awakening was is there wasn't anything laid at my feet, all the answers to the questions I wanted. It wasn't anything like that. I didn't have all of a sudden all these answers that I had been looking for. It was that I realized I didn't know anything for the first time in my life, and that I could surrender. I could just let it loose. And you would think, man, you come to the realization you really don't know anything, and you should be scared. I wasn't scared. I was at peace with knowing that I could relax, not act like I knew anything, be a sponge, and let this new way of life come into me. And I had been not scared, I just anxious up till that point. And there's a quote from Albert Camus that says that the only true philosophical question in the world is whether or not to commit suicide. And I hear the word suicide in these rooms a lot, usually in a good way because people are past that point. But I was born into a life of privilege. There's no reason I should be an alcoholic. My parents, my dad was an alcoholic, but he was an extremely high-functioning one, and they gave me everything, college education, every sports team I wanted to play on, every club I wanted to join. I had everything. But as I grew older, I would look at the word suicide, and I would say it was a weakness, that only selfish people and weak people would ever contemplate suicide. Well, as I continued on in life, I would say it was around college was when I really started to drink. I didn't have any problems as a youth. I didn't really start drinking until I was in college. I'm not going to win any pissing contests. I'm not going to be able to come up here and say that I drank this much vodka and I drank this. That wasn't the type of alcoholic I was. And that was hard at first in these rooms because you hear a lot of stories that are like, wow, maybe I'm. And the first thing you want to say when you drink like I did is that I'm not an alcoholic. Oh, that proves it. If you have to be like that to be an alcoholic, then I'm not an alcoholic. But this thing really hit home for me. What alcohol did to me, I wasn't drinking every day. But every time I had that first one, it was game on until the end. And I just thought that's the way people drank. I had no idea that was abnormal. I just thought, I mean, if you're going to drink, why not go all the way? Why not have as much as possible? And so I'm the typical guy where you throw a 12-pack in front of me and I look at the first one. I don't even enjoy the first one. I'm waiting for the second one, wondering when the third one's coming, wondering if we have enough for the rest of the night. It's just straight to that. And what... that's the laugh track. And so what it did to me, what alcohol did, alcohol was an absolute thief to me. Alcohol stole the things that I had really fostered in youth. I had a great self-confidence. I really thought I was going places. I really thought that I had the world by the tail. And as I drank more and more and more, I didn't see that I didn't. But the hangovers, it wasn't the pain in the morning. It was I could deal with any pain and just trudge on. It was the demoralization, the knowing that the night before I said I wasn't going to drink that night again, and I did. And I would wake up with the worst anxieties. I would wake up with night terrors. I would just feel so horrible. It was the same story you hear in here millions of times. You start looking in the mirror not liking who you're seeing, and it gets worse and worse and worse. But I'm not a very strong human being. I just go right through it. I'm not the type of person that's going to say, okay, enough is enough. I need to turn my life around. I am not that type of person. It takes something to happen in life. It takes a low for me. My low happened a year ago, where I was hiding my alcoholism at the time. I was pretending I was sober, and I was faking a business trip, and I was at my office in Orchid drinking, telling my family I was gone, and I thought I was caught. My wife pretty much texted me and said, "Where are you really?" And I said, "Oh, I better get to where I said I was." And I was already hammered, and I drove, and I made it a long way. I was supposed to go to Mojave. I made it about 3/4 of the way, and I think I fell asleep, so I don't remember a thing. But I got nailed by a semi-truck. And I kind of woke up. Man, I was out of it bad. But I knew what I had done, and I was at peace again. In the strangest thing, I was like, finally, I can turn the corner. Finally, something has got me so low that everyone can just give up on me. I can be as pathetic as I want, and I can either drink myself to death, or I can get sober. It was one of the two things. I had no idea. I didn't even have any idea that night or the next night which way it was going to go. But I knew it had to go some way. And I kept on thinking back to the suicide thing. I think, man, you know, this is the first time in my life. And if I don't have guts to turn my life around without having a low, I definitely don't have guts to commit suicide. Let's not fool I can't fool myself. But I knew in my head, I knew it clearer than any day that the people in my life's lives would be better if I didn't exist. The life insurance would take care of them. All the damage I do, all the stuff I create, all the negativity, they would be so much better. They could start over. My wife could find a real dad for the kids. And everything would be great for them if I wasn't here. That's a pretty bad place to be. That's no good. None of us should be in that place. And so when I got out, I expected my wife to leave me. I expected my kids to hate me. And it was the exact opposite. And I went, damn it. That's not what I expected. That's not what I wanted. I wanted to be able to give up. Now I have a responsibility. If they're going to back me after this crap, if they're going to back someone so pathetic and someone so useless at that point, now I got a darn responsibility. And so, first thing was first, I had to bring my wife to AA and show her that it sucked and that it was no place for my recovery and that we were going to have to find something else, but I had to show her first how bad it was. Because you guys scared me. Every single one of your faces frightened me. I said it last night. I was scared of you guys. You guys looked ugly and horrible because you reflected exactly what was wrong in me, and I did not want to see it. Now I look up, out across you guys, and I cannot find a more beautiful group of people. And I'm not kidding. I'm not saying that because I know your hearts. I know what this place has done for me. It has done absolute wonders. So that first meeting was amazing. I looked at her, and she looked at me, and I said, and she comes to my chips and stuff like that, but she has never come again because she knew I was in great hands. She knew that those people that swarmed me that night were going to get me back to who we all hoped I was, who I thought I was in my youth. And now I can look at that suicide thought and laugh at it and joke that I had those thoughts in my head because it's so far in the rearview mirror thanks to these rooms, thanks to you people, and thanks to the big book and those darn steps up there. All you newcomers, if you don't like being here, if you think it was what I wanted to prove to my wife, keep on thinking it, but don't stop coming. Because eventually, it took me 9 months. The 9 month was the turning point. I was in my car, and I knew something had happened, and he's here tonight. I called Matt D., And I said, something just happened, dude. Something just happened. I don't know what it is, and I can't even explain it to you. And he said, it's what I've been talking about. It's what the magic is. It's your first gift. It's your first promise being answered in these rooms. I thank the Lord for that. I thank the Lord for these rooms. Getting to sit, stand up and speak in front of you guys is terrifying, but it is also magical. Mm-hmm. It's part of the recovery process. And back to the newcomers, there are so many of you, and this is the right. You're in the right place. You're in the place that can really make a difference in your life. It has in mine. And the best part about it is that I don't know anything yet. I don't know anything. I just scratched the surface of where I want to go and scratched the surface of what this place can offer me. And I haven't gotten all of the promises yet, and I'm so excited. I can't wait to get through these meetings. I can't wait to read the big book because, man, what they say, what you guys have said, no matter what I thought at first when you said it and how, all the illogical stuff I thought that the steps were and all the stuff that I thought would not come, it comes. Especially when you surrender and let someone else take the wheel. Is that 10 minutes? Oh, I have a few more. And that's another thing. I'm a libertarian because I believe in liberty to the core. You don't want to get in a political discussion with me because I hate both sides. And no matter which way you come, I can't stand it. But because of my libertarian leanings, I said I will never be a victim of anything. Nothing. I'll survive anything. I really thought this, but coming into these rooms and getting rid of my alcoholism, I had to face a lot of facts and a lot of the surrendering. Surrendering is such an easy word to say. It's a freaking hard thing to do. And I had to realize that I was a victim. The whole time I was screaming to myself that I'm not a victim. I'm strong. I'll get through anything. I was a victim of so many things that I would never grow as a human being if I didn't get past. I was a victim of alcohol. That's obvious. I was a victim of absolutely terrible decisions. I was such a selfish person. I was a victim to my own selfishness. Selfishness does not get you what you think it's going to get you. It's getting past that selfishness. And I don't know if I'll ever fully get past it, but all I can do is work at it. But selfishness does not get you what you think it's going to get you. It gets you the exact opposite. So surrendering was overly hard for me because I had to get past who I was in the past, really what I thought in the past, which was a terrible lie, is that I was a victim of nothing and I could get through anything. I couldn't get through what I was going through. Not if I didn't surrender, not if I came to the realization that I was a victim, and I'm a victim in many more ways than I ever wanted to admit. And I think that's all I got. Kevin Alcoholic, thanks a lot.
Oh, let's give Kevin another round. Thank you so much. Okay, before we get started with the main speaker, this very front seat's going to be free, and there's a seat up here, so if you want to make your way up here, that's fine, and everyone wants to get situated so everybody can be comfortable, but... So, all right, I'm so excited to introduce Jose Daniel from Santa Maria.
Did it just get hot in here?
Yeah.
Jose Daniel, alcoholic. I just want to say thank you to Vicky for allowing me to come up here and speak. It's a privilege and an honor to be able to pass along what so freely has been given to me. My sobriety date, 7/11/15. I have a home group, which is the Tuesday Night Lion's Den. And I have two commitment meetings, which is the Monday night airport and the Friday night podium participation meeting. And I'll go into a little bit about why I say that and why I think it's important. But before I start, a couple disclaimers. So I'm not an authority on the Big Book or AA or the 12 steps or 12 traditions. I'm just sharing my experience, strength, and hope. And so if there's something that I say that you can't rectify with the first 164 pages of the book, or if it's something that you're that doesn't correlate with what your sponsor's saying, just disregard what I'm saying. The other one is I don't have anything original to share. Everything that that comes out of my mouth tonight is things that I've heard you guys say. Nothing is original. So if I had something original, I'd probably charge you guys for it. So the reason that I'm here in these rooms is because I'm an alcoholic. And so what that means is that whenever I have a drink and I put that into my body, it doesn't matter what kind of drink or how much alcohol it has in it, there's only one of two things that can happen, right? I'm either going to control my drinking, and that looks a little something like this. I'm hanging out with some friends. We're barbecuing. Everybody's having a good time. I'm throwing back a couple, and my wife comes up to me, and she goes, "Hey, you've had enough." You know, at that point, because I'm scared of my wife, I'm going to stop drinking, right? But I'm not going to enjoy from that point forward. I don't know if you guys can relate with that, but the way that I enjoy my drinking is the second thing that can happen once I introduce that alcohol into my body. I need to put as much alcohol as possible, as fast as possible, and that's how I enjoy my drinking. That's the kind of drunk that I am. I don't stop drinking until there's consequences. And the consequences can be relatively minor, like it's past 2 o'clock and all the booze is gone, you know? And they could be, you know, bigger than that. You know, I get pulled aside by my boss because I just jumped in butt naked into his pool in front of all his families for the Christmas party, you know, and there's 100 people that just watch me do that, and they lock me up in a room so I can't get out, you know, so the consequences can be one way or another. Now, when it all started, I don't know. The book talks about that there's a point in our drinking that we probably become alcoholic. We just don't notice it because, you know, drinking is still fun. I know that in my family, we drink, and drinking as kids is something that's accepted, you know. It's not like they're handing me drinks, but they just look the other way. I remember being maybe 4 or 5 years old and my grandmother slipping me drinks at a graduation party. That's probably the youngest I remember drinking. And from there, it was always, you know, the grown-ups giving you a sip of beer, or, you know, maybe at a toast they'll give you a glass of champagne. But that's not what makes me an alcoholic again. When I started noticing that I didn't really fit in, that I didn't feel comfortable around anybody, I think that that's where my alcoholism begins. From a very, very young age, I'd say right around 11 or 12, I started noticing that I didn't feel a part of. I didn't feel like I was good enough for you to be around. That just kind of progressed. And that got worse and worse the older that I got. I think that that's irritable, discontent, you know, restless. I didn't realize it at the time, of course. And we started having issues at my house. We were a very poor family, and I was a tornado. I was a tornado, like the book says, just destroying anything in my path. As a consequence, when I was 13, I left my home and I never went back. And ever since then, up until 18, foster homes, institutions, halfway houses, the streets, that's how I grew up from 13 to 18. During that time, I started running into alcohol. But more than alcohol, I started running into weed, right? And I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, but my disease, I know that I can pinpoint it to when I was about 15 or 16 that I realized that if I provided my peers with alcohol or weed or whatever it was, I could use daily for free. And because I had friends that were older than 21, I could always have a pretty decent supply of booze or herb or whatever it is. At 15, that's when I started my daily use. And it was always alcohol. And if I couldn't get alcohol, well, something else, you know, could replace that. At the time, things were fun. Things were really fun. You know, we'd go hang out at the beach and have bonfires all night long. If the ranger showed up, we'd dig a hole and put all our booze in there. And, you know, no, officer, you know, everything's fine over here. And everything just kept on being one big party. One big party. I graduated from college at around 22. I got a job. The job paid me decent. I could live, you know, I could drink, I could have fun, go on vacations. So the whole alcoholism thing wasn't really in my mind. But I was drinking alcoholically at that point. Anytime that we'd go pick up a bottle, the bottle was gone that night. And if it was still before 2 a.m., we'd go get another one. I never drank to hang out with you guys. I never drank, hey, let's have one and barbecue. You know, if you showed up to hang out with me and all you had was a six-pack of beer, I'm baffled. I'm confused because what are we going to do with a six-pack of beer? You know? Things kept on going really good. When the financial market crashed, in 2007, I had a 9-year relationship end. I got fired from my job, and I was kind of at a low financially. I don't think emotionally or spiritually I was at a low just yet. But I decided to get into real estate at that point. I just figured, get in when it's low. I don't know. There's a lot of jobs out there, especially if they're sales related or commission related, alcohol is a big part of what you do. You know, you work, you're not getting paid by the hour, you do this big sale and everybody celebrates. You deliver a house with champagne or tequila, and you know, from there you just kind of keep it going. And alcoholism wasn't really a word that I associated with me at that point, you know, just because I started making money. I started making friends. I would wear a suit every day. I drove a nice car. And things were good. Things were really, really good. But when I think, looking behind that imaginary line that we could stop at that point drinking and, you know, not be alcoholic, I had already crossed it. A while ago. Things went really good for about 7, 8, 9 years. I think that what happened is that at one point I started believing my own hype. Because I've never felt comfortable. I've never felt like I was one of you guys. I've never felt like I was worthy of having what I had. And once I started getting the things that I felt I didn't deserve, it was really confusing. It was really, really confusing. Because I'm not supposed to have, you know, the beautiful wife. I'm not supposed to have this, you know, great paying job. And the weight of that really drew me into drinking. It just pushed me into drinking. That's when I started noticing that I was drinking alcoholically. You know, anybody that has 21 drinks is going to do something stupid, right? But the unmanageable part of this for me isn't so much that one, if I have 21 drinks, I'm going to do something stupid. It's that the next day, I'm going to tell myself this is never going to happen again. I'm going to make a solemn promise. I'm going to believe it in my heart. I'm not lying. I'm being 100% truthful that this is not going to happen again, right? And the book talks about I'm defenseless against that first drink. Once that first drink is offered to me, or once I get around that drink, it's not like I go, well, maybe this time will be different. I don't even remember making that promise. I don't even remember feeling the way that I felt the night after, you know? My coworkers started saying, hey, man, do you think you're okay? And these are people that drank with me during all these times of celebration. I started feeling more isolated from my work. I started feeling more isolated from my family, from my friends, because I didn't want them to let me know that they were concerned about my drinking. And so the more I isolated, the more I drank. The more I drank, the more isolated I became. It came to a point where financially and on the outside, everything looked great. I was doing really well. But on the inside, I was just done. It's not that I wanted to die. It's that I just didn't want to be. I didn't want to be who I was. I didn't want to be around anybody, you know. And I remember I had a bottle that I had been saving for a long time. My last drink, July 10th, 2015, there was a big, huge meeting, right? And I felt like I was disrespected at that meeting in front of a lot of other people within our work. And so I went home really, really mad. And I said, well, you know, might as well pop open this bottle of 1963 single malt, right? And I'm sitting there, and I pour myself like two fingers, and I look at it, and I know that once I drink that, like, there's no stopping me. There is absolutely nothing that is going to get in my way from me separating myself from my consciousness, right? But I took that drink anyways, right? At that point, I was still drinking to feel better. I was still drinking to have fun. I was still drinking to forget. But after that drink, and after the second drink and the third drink, I didn't forget. My anger about the way that I was disrespected just kept on burning hotter and hotter and hotter. And three quarters of the way through that bottle, I decided that I just couldn't stand it anymore. So I walked into the bathroom, and I took every single pill that I could find. Every single pill. I don't remember. I don't remember past that first drink thinking that if I drink this, nothing is going to get in my way from separating myself from my consciousness. I don't remember any of that. From what my wife tells me, she found me butt naked in the bathtub, unconscious. My wife is about 5'2", weighs 90 pounds, and she was pregnant at the time, maybe 6 months, 7 months pregnant. I don't know how she did it, but she got me dressed, got me into a car, and took me to the emergency room. Little tiny thing, pregnant. I'm going to be making amends to her for a while. And it's okay. It's okay. The next thing that I remember is waking up and instantly realizing that I was alive and thinking, damn it, you can't do anything right. You know? And then I look over at my side, and my wife is there, all teary-eyed, and the first thing that she says to me is, I can't live without you, you know? And so now I have a decision to make, right? Do I keep living the way that I've been living, not doing anything right? Or do I try something because this woman that's going to give birth to my only child in a few months, you know, deserves that. The psych techs came in because they talk to you and, you know, they try to figure out if you're going to kill yourself or not. I wasn't in good shape. I wasn't in good shape at all. And they told me that I was going to go into like a hospital, like a real psychiatric hospital after the 3-day stay. So on the third day, there's a psychiatrist that comes in to do an evaluation, right? And the psychiatrist and I start talking. And immediately, that persona, that fakeness that I've always carried with me in order for you to accept me, kicks on. And I say all the right things. Listen, I was just having fun. I drank too much. I took my medication. I must have, you know, overdone it. But look, I have a plan. I'm going to go to counseling. I'm going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm going to make sure that this doesn't happen again because, you know, and I just gave them the whole spiel. Right? And they decided to let me go from the hospital after that 72-hour stay. And they probably shouldn't have. They probably shouldn't have. But I got all my stuff. I got home. And I closed the door. And I looked at my wife. And she looked so excited. She's like, I'm so glad you have a plan. You know? And it hit me. At that point, I wasn't lying to the psychiatrist that was, you know, going to let me out of the hospital or not. I was lying to my wife. This person that saved my life. And it's one thing to lie and be like, I'm never going to drink again and really feel it. Really, really feel it. Feel that you are being honest with yourself or another person. I'm never going to drink again. That's never going to happen again. It's another thing to deliberately lie and say that you're going to turn your life around, whether it was directed to her or not. But I just felt that was my low. My low wasn't waking up at the hospital. My low wasn't staying 72 hours there. You know, my low was realizing that once again, I had purposely lied to my wife and that I was not going to follow through. But she was so excited and just kept on talking about it and talking about it. So I said, okay, well, let's look up when the next Alcoholics Anonymous meeting is. I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I looked it up. It was a Monday night when they let me out, and it was the newcomers meeting that I went to. And lo and behold, the subject was honesty. Right? And pretty much what I told them was like, hey, you know, I just lied to this doctor and they let me out, you know, and they probably shouldn't let me out because I don't know if I can do this thing called life, right? And after the meeting, you guys did what you guys do to newcomers. You know, there was like a donut of people around me giving me, hey, this is the next meeting. I'll see you over there at 8:00 tomorrow morning. Hey, here's my phone number, you know? So I was automatically drawn to you guys just because of how happy you guys looked. I had never been to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I had never talked to anybody from Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea what Alcoholics Anonymous was all about. But just that first experience that I had with you guys was enough for me to come back the next day, you know? And from there, it all started my journey into sobriety. So I do 5 things to stay sober, right? And they kind of went, my sobriety went in this order, right? I go to meetings that first Monday. The next day, I went to 3 or 4 meetings because I made such a big show at my work that they weren't going to let me back in, you know. I say that they disrespected me at that big, huge meeting, but the book talks about how we step on our fellows' feet and toes, and then we're like, when they retaliate, we're like, oh, poor little me, you know. and that's what happened, you know. In the beginning of my alcoholism, I was delusional. And not delusional because I believed in fairies or something like that. I was delusional because I thought that the life that I was living was the only life that people lived. I thought that drinking was normal. I thought that, you know, every once in a while you're just going to make a fool out of yourself. And, you know, this is how people live, right? I was just so caught up in myself that I couldn't see past that, right? The next day, I went and the last meeting of the day was at the Lion's Den. I noticed somebody that I knew from like 15, 20 years ago that I used to party with, and I go up to him and I'm like, hey man, how's it going, bro? I don't know if you remember me. He's like, oh, how's it going? You know, and we talked a little bit. And then I turned around and I was about to walk away and he goes, hey, if you need help, let me know. And I walked to the door and I turned around and I go, hey Shane, I do need help. And he goes, I'll be your sponsor. You know, so that's number two. I go to meetings, I got a sponsor. And he goes, hey, so my next meeting is Thursday at the 1600 Club, right? I want you to be there. Right? Okay. So I come here to the 1600 Club. He's here, and he's like, Sunday, I want you at my house, and or at Starbucks, actually. I still looked a little grimy to go to his house. He goes, we're going to go to Starbucks, and we're going to start working on the steps. Right? And we dove right into the steps. I know some people take one step a month or whatever they do. At that point, I was dying. My alcoholism was going to kill me. And I needed some... A lot of people say, hey, just put the plug in the jug or just don't pick up. Don't drink between meetings. That wasn't sufficient for me. My whole life after just being plastered and waking up with that pitiful demoralization, I wanted to put the plug in the jug. I wanted to not drink anymore. What kept me from drinking was diving into those steps and continuously going to meetings. At that point, I was going to 2, 3, 4 meetings a day. I know that some people can't do that, but it really, I'm really fortunate that I could, that my boss didn't want me at work, you know. I got a big book. I started reading it right away. When I read the doctor's opinion, and it talked about the allergy, the obsession, I automatically knew that they were talking about me. I knew 100% that I was an alcoholic. I knew I was an alcoholic before, but I thought that I was an alcoholic because I just like to drink a lot, you know? When I read the doctor's opinion, I realized the specifics behind it, right? So I go to meetings, I got a sponsor, I got a big book, I work the steps, and then I'm passing it on, right? I've worked the steps. I feel like I've recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. But that being recovered from that hopeless state of mind and body is only contingent on my spiritual condition. So I know that although today I feel great being up here and passing on what has so freely been given to me, that doesn't mean that I'm not going to drink tomorrow. Right? And I have to do what the drunks do in these rooms in order to keep from drinking. My first year sober was kind of weird, right? Because they told me like 3-4 weeks into it, my sponsor goes, man, you're on this pink cloud, right? And this pink cloud, that's why you're so happy. And I think that pink cloud comes into a... It has to do with the fact that you're not drinking to the point that your body is breaking down, you know? So if you don't drink, you don't have those hangovers, you don't have those big, huge bouts of demoralization, you know? So just stopping drinking makes you feel good, right? But I have to say that although the pink cloud isn't mentioned in the first 164 pages, it does talk about happy, joyous, and free. I'd like to think that when people talk about the pink cloud, they're talking about happy, joyous, and free, right? And so I'd say that with the exception of a couple of short periods of time, 85% of the time I'm on this pink cloud. Happy, joyous, and free, right? My first year, I remember it's 2 months into it, it started hitting me. It started hitting that this was going to be a huge change. It started hitting me that I wasn't getting patted on the back for being sober, you know? My wife wasn't giving me extra points just because I wasn't drinking. You know, my job was not going to take me back just because I was sober, you know? So I started having anxiety, right? I remember being in this room and we were going to pray out and they wouldn't hold my hands. They held my elbows because I was just dripping sweat, right? Whenever I have that, at 2 months, I remember that was the first time that I really, really felt that restless, irritable, and discontent feeling, right? And so when I talked to my sponsor about it, he goes, look, we all go through that. But the solution lies in the first 164 pages. It lies in those 12 steps, right? So we started doing more work. I kept on reading the book. If something didn't make sense to me, I asked somebody. I kept on hanging out with you guys, right? That taught me something really, really simple. That as an alcoholic, whenever I am not having a balanced recovery, unity service and recovery up there, I'm going to get to a point where I'm restless, irritable, and discontent, right? Once that starts happening, my thinking is going to be affected by it in a negative way. If I let that, then sanity is going to set back in, and then I'm going to drink, right? That's how it was explained to me by my sponsor. So when I talked to my sponsor about how restless, irritable, and discontent I felt, and those weren't the words that I was using. I was using, look, man, I can't stop sweating. I can't sleep. You know, I'm going on, you know, walking my dog at 3 o'clock in the morning because I just can't stand laying in bed, you know. He goes, look, we're going to get back into this. And we got into it. And it wasn't immediately, but within a week, I was feeling that happy, joyous, and free again, right? So now, I still experience that. And whenever I'm not happy, joyous, and free, right, I ask myself, is this okay feeling this way, right? Because up until the time that I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know how to deal with my feelings, right? So last year, my grandmother passed away, right? So obviously, I was not happy, joyous, and free, you know? But I stopped and I asked myself, you know, is it okay for me to mourn, to, you know, is it okay for me to feel this way? Of course it is, you know? It's just that every single other time that anybody else had passed away, you know, those feelings, you sprinkle alcohol all over them, and you don't feel them at all, you know? And you could be happy at the funeral and laughing, you know, being, oh, I'm going to laugh because, you know, that's how he wanted me to, be at his funeral. But it's not that. It's that, you know, alcohol makes you forget. Alcohol makes you not care, you know. So grandmother passed away. It's okay for me to feel that way. But if I stop and I do an inventory on myself and I go, the reason that I'm feeling this way is because I'm not doing what I'm supposed to be doing. Then I talk to my sponsor. I talk to people with time. I get into that book. I come to more meetings. And I try to figure out what it is. Going through the steps was life-changing, right? So anybody that's new, talk to somebody that's gone through the steps and has a sponsor. And ask them to be your sponsor. Even if you don't like them, tell them, I'll be my temporary sponsor, right? Because this is life or death for me, right? Have that person lead you through the 12 steps like their sponsor led you through the 12 steps, you know? And at the end of it all, your life is going to be better. Your life is going to be better. It's not going to be perfect. You're not going to get the castle and the, you know, the horse and all that, but it's going to be a heck of a lot better than it was when you were at one. You know? I wake up in the morning. I ask God to guide me, to show me what He wants me to do. I say the third step prayer, you know, because I feel that in my core I'm selfish, I'm self-centered. I still want to, if I let go of what you guys have taught me, I'm still going to try to get as much benefit from you. So I have to make sure that in the mornings I ask God to separate me from myself, and that He can show me His will in order for me to continue to be happy, joyous, and free, right? And newcomers, I know that like people talk about God, and it can be uncomfortable, but if you're not comfortable with it, just do it without believing in God. Just do it and fake it. You know, there's plenty of us that were atheists and agnostics, and maybe still are, that have gone through the 12 steps, and their higher power is these rooms, is these people. You know, don't get hung up on God. Once I do my prayers, I try to figure out what I'm going to do for that day, and I try to see where I'm going to be of service. You know, whether at work, with my family, in the rooms, with my friends. And then I go about my day. If I feel like I did something that I need to make amends for, I do it as fast as possible. Because those amends eat me up. Eat me up. Completely. There was a point in my recovery where my wife wanted me to clean the barbecue pit before we barbecued, right? And I'm cleaning the barbecue pit to the best of my ability, but it wasn't good for her. And I go, "It's clean." And she goes, "Stop yelling at me." And I hadn't yelled at her, right? And so I yelled as loud as I could, "I'm not yelling." And my wife is this little tiny thing. And she just cowered down. She started to yell and scream, like, you know, but I could see it in her eyes how much fear I had put in her just by screaming. I knew immediately that I had to make amends. But I wasn't going to be able to make amends with her being that way, in that state of mind, and me being still all pumped up. Our book talks about pause, you know. And so I took off, and I do what you guys told me to do. I started down the list of phone numbers. I called my sponsor, he wasn't there. I called my sponsor's sponsor, he wasn't there. I called a third person, he picked up the phone. And he does what we do. "Come on over." I told him what happened. He goes, "Look, you need to do a fourth step about this." And we sat down and we wrote down the fourth step just like it says it in the book, right? I felt so much better until I got home and I had to deal with my wife, you know? And I did my amends, but she didn't care. She did not care, you know? But I knew that it was my fault. And I knew that for the next few days, I was going to have to deal with that, you know? Eventually, I explained to her. I go, "Look, I'm at fault because of this and this and this, you know? Needless to say now, whenever we're going to barbecue, I make sure to wash the grill as she wants me to wash it, you know? But that fourth step, that fourth step is something that before you do it, you're super uncomfortable, right? Because you're going to have to look at yourself. You're going to have to look at the ugliness that that led you to a point that grew resentment or fear or sexual misbehavior. Man, that's a bad one, right? But on the other side, you do it just like the book says. 1, 2, 3, 4. And on the other side, you get to know a little bit more about yourself. And the more you know about yourself through that fourth step, the more you can separate yourself from that type of behavior, from that, and the more you can align yourself with God's will, I think, right? So now I don't drink. I still practice the 12 steps. I still talk to my sponsor. I still read the big book. I still pray in the morning. At night, I still take an inventory. I do all the amends that I need to do. And just because I do the amends that I need to do, I find myself that I'm not doing things to offend people. And I think it's because I hate doing amends, you know? So I would much rather not do something that is going to need an amends, you know? These are all the things that I do to stay sober, right? I'm still one drink away from losing everything again, right? And I understand that. But I know that that's not an option if I want to continue living. I know that it talks about, you know, you have to smash it, you know, that thought. I think on a regular basis I do that, you know, because you turn on the TV and you see the sands, and the hammock, and the palm trees, and then the Corona bottle, and it looks so cool, you know, on a hot day at the beach. But that's not the type of person that I am. I have to smash it right then and there, you know, because it's not going to be two or three beers in a bucket, you know. It's going to be me ending up in the hospital or dead, you know. That's why I do what we do. I think that I owe Alcoholics Anonymous my life, and I know that that's the truth. Some people say, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, right? I love Alcoholics Anonymous a lot, and sometimes I don't like it that much. You know, on those days that I'm like, oh, I don't want to get up and go to a meeting, or oh, I know that I shouldn't be doing this, I know that I should be picking up the phone and reaching out, you know. But you guys have taught me that when I am in that position, I probably should do the things that I don't want to do, you know. So, yeah, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of people say, this is the best thing that's ever happened to me. I think this is the second best thing that's ever happened to me. My wife tells me over and over and over again that the best thing that ever happened to me is me marrying her. You know? And I know it's true because she's never wrong. So, I'm super happy to be here. I'm super happy to be sober. And this thing that we do works, man. And so I like the results that I've been getting from doing the work, from doing what you guys have told me to do. So I'm going to continue doing it. Tomorrow I'm going to wake up with a blank slate and hopefully do the things that I do that make me feel like I've recovered from that hopeless state of mind and body. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Jose Daniel. Let's give him another hand.